Silence.
Oppenheimer.
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
This is Nerd Prey Radio.
Nerd alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 217 of Nerd Pride Radio. 217. I did a Google search for the number, and I got one of my results listed a world record 217 kilogram snatch. An actual thing. It was a record set by Lasha Talakadze of the nation of Georgia at the weightlifting championships of April of last year. I've never known anything about the snatch as a weightlifting move other than the fact that it makes an appearance in the song I Can Make You a Man in the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And even then, I only knew it was a weightlifting term because it was followed by the clean and jerk, which also sounds dirty, but apparently the snatch, I didn't know what it was as a weightlifting move. So I looked it up, and apparently it's where you get the huge weight from the floor to an overhead lift in a single continuous motion. Okay, that was probably common sense. Maybe everyone knew that, but I didn't. But I knew it was a type of lift. So, learn something new every day. Ask me how I'm doing today. Go on. Ask me. I'm awesome. My name is Mike Jones. I'm a D&D/Pathfinder nerd, a history nerd, a sci-fi nerd, a comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, comedy nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd plus. There's like seven other kinds of nerd. I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You are listening to Nerd Pride Radio. This is the place I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff that just won't fit in my skull anymore. My co-host this week was going to be Miss White, but she had an unfortunate accident, and so we're just lucky that Dr. Orchid was able to fill in at the last minute. So let's make her feel welcome. And now it's time for the meticulously plotted portion of the podcast. This is the time for me where I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. If something strikes me as interesting during the course of my busy week, and they have been busy lately, I add it to my master list, and the very best stuff off of that list gets spewed out all over you guys every week when I record. You lucky dogs. Right into it. First up, my unnamed history segment.
Don't know much about history.
Okay, just a fair warning. This is a history segment about the Zaporozhian Cossacks of Russia, I suppose. Ukraine, probably. Anyway, it's about the Zaporozhian Cossacks, and they apparently are a very foul-mouthed bunch, and so there's going to be some very strong language in this segment, which I don't think any of you mind, but, you know, I'm just giving you a warning. They're kind of foul-mouthed. So, I'm listening to, I'm reading, actually. Oh, I'm reading, Words on the Move by John McWhorter, which was recommended to me by Nelly. So thank you, Nelly. I'm actually really enjoying the book. But he makes a reference in it to the look on the scribe's face in the painting of the Zaporozhian Cossacks. And it's the official title of the painting is something along the lines of "The Zaporozhian Cossacks Write a Letter to the Sultan of Turkey." Or, alternately, it's the Zaporozhian Cossacks writing a mocking letter to the Sultan of Turkey. Either way, it's a painting by Ilya Repin, and he painted this in 1881, something like that. So in the book, McWhorter makes a reference to this painting, and I am fascinated just by his reference. It's a very tongue-in-cheek sort of reference because he describes it. And then after he describes it, he gives the title of the painting, which is almost exactly the description he just gave. So he was just playing with words there. But it intrigued me enough that I had to go look up the painting. And oh my God, I love this painting. All right. If you have not seen, the Zaporozhian Cossacks writing a letter to the Sultan of Turkey. Do an image search for it. Just write Cossacks writing a letter to the Sultan of Turkey. And you will find this painting, and it is hysterical, and it is brilliant, and it's really, really good. Like I say, painted 140 years ago. Alright, here's the story behind it first. I mean, you go look at the painting now. I'll describe it in a little bit. But, you can go look at the painting now if you want. And here's what happens. So, in 1676, in a war between the Cossacks and the Ottoman Empire, Mehmed IV, the Sultan of Turkey at the time, was getting his ass kicked by the Cossacks, supposedly. And yet he very brazenly sent them a letter demanding their surrender. And then they supposedly sent a very very colorful and disrespectful reply back to him and his request. Now, this is just a famous legend in the area. And the original reply as written doesn't exist today. All right, nobody knows where it is. However, in the 1870s, some amateur historian or whatever in the area came across what he said was a copy of it from the 18th century. So at the time that he found it, it would have been already 100 years old, if it was even historically accurate. But he gives it to some Russian historian, Dmitry Yarvin, I should have practiced these pronunciations ahead of time. Yarvonitsky, there we go. And so he gives it to an amateur historian who is reading it to his guests, and among the guests happens to be Ilya Repin. And Ilya Repin was so enamored of this story that he decided to create this painting. Now, here's the original letter from the Sultan, according to this this translation. So you got to imagine, the Cossacks have been winning here, all right? They've been beating his armies back, rebuffing his advances into their territory, and so imagine their reaction when they receive this letter from Mehmed IV, Sultan of Turkey. As the Sultan, the letter goes, son of Muhammad, brother of the sun and moon, grandson and viceroy of God, ruler of the kingdoms of Macedonia, Babylon, Jerusalem, Upper and Lower Egypt, emperor of emperors, sovereign of sovereigns, extraordinary knight never defeated, steadfast guardian of the tomb of Jesus Christ, trustee chosen by God himself, the hope and comfort of Muslims, confounder and great defender of the Christians, I command you, the he spells it slightly differently, but Zaporizhian Cossacks, to submit to me voluntarily and without any resistance, and to desist from troubling me further with your attacks. Signed, the Turkish Sultan Mehmed IV. Now, the Cossacks reply, and supposedly in the original language it rhymed, which I so wish I had that, because that could only make this better. But the supposed reply of the Cossacks went a little something like this. From the Zaporozhian Cossacks to the Turkish Sultan. O Sultan, Turkish devil, and by the way, the original translation that they have here, I'm taking a lot of this from Wikipedia, but the original translation they have here has lots of these and thous and thines in it, which it's being translated from Russian or Ukrainian rhymes that I don't know why they're choosing the King James version of the language here. So I'm updating those, so I'll just say you instead of thy. So, you know, just bear with me. So I'm taking a few liberties here. But anyway, the Zaporozhian Cossacks to the Turkish Sultan. O Sultan, Turkish devil and damned devil's kith and kin, secretary to Lucifer himself. What the devil kind of knight are you that you can't even slay a hedgehog with your own naked ass? The devil shits and your army eats. Thou shall not, you son of a whore, make subjects of Christian sons. We have no fear of your army. By land and by sea, we will battle with you and fuck your mother. Now, parenthetically here, I don't know if they actually mean that they were going to fuck his mother, or just, you know, the generalized term, you know, fuck your mother, like to hell with her. I don't know what they meant. The translation doesn't say. But that's not all. They continue. You Babylonian scullion, Macedonian wheelwright, brewer of Jerusalem, goat fucker of Alexandria. Okay, I gotta step off here for a second and say goat fucker of Alexandria is, by the way, my favorite portion of this entire thing, as they're playing off of his own titles that he's given them. Back into it. Swineherd of Greater and Lesser Egypt, pig of Armenia, Podolian thief, catamite of Tartary, hangman of the Camunets, and fool of all the world and underworld, an idiot before God, grandson of the serpent, and the crick in our dick. Okay, crick in our dick takes a really close second to goatfucker of Alexandria, but bear with me. Pig snout, mare's ass, slaughterhouse cur, unchristened brow, screw your own mother. They're very heavy on him fucking his mother. So the Zaporozhians declare you lowlife. You won't even be herding pigs for the Christians. Now we'll conclude, for we don't know the date, and we don't know the calendar. The moon's in the sky, and the year's with the Lord, and the day's here the same as it is over there. So, for all that, kiss our asses. I was hoping it would say kiss our collective asses. Has a better rhythm for me, but good enough. Signed, Koshavia Odoman, Ivan Serko, and the whole Zaporozhian host. Oh, it's beautiful. Okay, so now, taking that, this is what Ilya Repin would have heard read off. Okay, so you imagine their, you know, upper crust dinner party, and someone's reading this off, and they're all having their little titters and giggles just like we are here, because this is funny stuff, and you know, racy, risque. But for him, he's inspired. And now go check out the painting, because the whole point of this painting, you got that, the scribe in the middle, and then all these Cossacks surrounding him, and they are, every one of them, unique, colorful, awesome characters, these guys. You're looking at all of them, and you know every one of them has a story that would make an awesome character in a role-playing game. I wanna play these barbarians. Oh man, they are awesome. All right. And you can see them, and the way they're laughing, and the sly looks, and you just know that these are guys ribbing each other on to see who can come up with the best, most offensive insult to throw into this letter for the Sultan. They're just trying to top each other with the worst things they can possibly say to this pompous ass. And it's beautiful. It's gorgeous. I love this painting. It's my new favorite painting. It's just amazing. And so there you go. That's a little piece of history for you guys today. Go look that thing up. It is awesome. All right. Now, into the next segment. Oh, you're going to need to get the little ones out of the room. Make sure you're sitting down for this.
Nerd rage came flashing back, and I just looked at him and went, Rrr!
That's right. It's time for some nerd rage. All right. My buddy Yancey, my office mate at work, he has been going back and getting his undergraduate's degree. He's never had one, and he figured it was about time. And so he is getting his undergraduate's degree online from Bellevue University. It's Bellevue, Nebraska. So it's actually the college my mom got a degree from back when I was in high school. So that was really cool. But they offer online programs, and seems a little pricey, but it met his needs. And so he's getting his degree. And he's now in the last set of classes for this. And up till now, he's been doing, you know, a bunch of stuff on management styles and business classes and all sorts of different stuff. And this final class is different, really different. And he's asking me some questions about it, because he's like, all right, Dad, would you read this the same way I would? I think I have a problem here. Okay. The class he's required to take is the Kirkpatrick Signature Series. It's 9 credit hours worth of classes from Bellevue University, and the Kirkpatrick Signature Series is unique to Bellevue University, and it is required for all undergraduate degrees from the university. So if you want to graduate from Bellevue today, you need to take this 9 hours worth of classes. It is part of every single degree they have. And it is, without a doubt, unadulterated conservative. I mean, like, hardcore constitutionalist party, make America great again, Tea Party conservative is what this thing is. And, you know, that's okay. You know, if you want to have conservative-leaning professors, if you want to have conservative-leaning curriculum, that's your choice, all right? They can do that as an American institution. Conservatives are complaining all the time that America's colleges are brainwashing our youth with their liberal propaganda and agenda and blah, 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 blah. So I guess turnabout is fair play, right? But this is different. This is to a degree, and you know, and I suppose if I were conservative, I suppose I would find, I would see examples of this everywhere on the liberal side, but I'm telling you, this is just gross. It is, first off, he was very interested because the first assignment was, is America the greatest country on earth? That was the essay they had to write, is America the greatest country on earth? And it is, it was a short essay, and they were told very specifically, there's no right or wrong answer here. We just want your opinion. And so Yancey wrote that, you know, look, by certain traditional measures, you can look out, you know, you can check military might, and you can check gross domestic product, and you can check, and, you know, he said, by a lot of measures, we're number one in a lot of these measures. That would seem to make us great, right? But then he said, but then there's a lot of other things where I think we fall short. And his ultimate answer to them was, I don't think we are the greatest country on earth, but I think we have the potential to be. It's within us, and we just need to live up to it. We have everything here. Let's do this. All right. That's his answer. And he was told by the professor, oh, yeah, no, that's not right. But you said there were no wrong answers. Right. But see, you're only allowed to use reference material from the required readings. Oh, that's tricky. See, because he did things like, it's not like he went out and looked up a bunch of stuff. He quoted Martin Luther King. He quoted, you know, just stuff that he happens to know off the top of his head, because he's not going to go out and do, you know, any of that extra work. But if he knows it, you know, this was a short essay. And so the professor's like, yeah, you can't use any of those outside quotes. You're supposed to use just the material we give you. Oh, yeah, that makes it really different. So even though you told us there's no wrong answer, apparently there's a wrong answer. So we delve into the required reading, and I say we because he comes into work about once a week during this course, and he's like, okay, you've got to check out this paper. Just look, this is just, again, part of the required reading. And there's videos, and there's books, and there's essays, and this kind of stuff. And it is stuff like, one of them, we're listening to this speaker who is talking about power. And he says, power is the ability to make other people do what you want. And that's a good thing. All right. And like the whole time this guy is going on about power, and power is the ability to force people to do what you want them to do. Like there were ways that you could have phrased this that I could have agreed with it and thought, you know, yeah, I get what you're saying, is that, look, this is the ability to have influence. Like, we all have our opinions, and we would like to persuade others that ours is the right way of doing things, and we would like to, but they didn't phrase it that. They didn't soften it in any way. It's just, no, power is forcing other people to do what you want. It very, very Atlas Shrugged, it felt like. It was really, it felt like any moment Gordon Gekko was going to go greed, for lack of a better word. I mean, it was right there. And it just felt, again, it just felt icky. And also, these are the required readings and the required viewings. And when you write your papers for this class, you are only allowed to use that material. So Yancey says, you know, they give us a list of historical documents that we can use to write this next paper. And he says, you know, they include the Constitution. So you're allowed to quote the Constitution, but you're not allowed to quote any of the amendments, not even the first 10, not even the Bill of Rights. And he said, oh, yeah, and the Declaration of Independence, not included. He said, you know what? When you have just the Constitution without the Bill of Rights, without the Declaration of Independence as a prologue, he said, do you know how tough it is to say anything about human rights at all? Because it's not in there. But that's, it's that kind of thing that they shape the readings so that you have to come to certain conclusions. And their certain conclusions are the power of citizenship, the power of having a strong sense of community and a strong sense of shared values as a nation as a whole, to increase citizenship and patriotism, and thus to make America great. And this is, you know, there's some of it that I can see where it would be appealing. I can see where there's some of this where you'd sit down and go, well, yeah, some of that makes a little bit of sense. Maybe I wouldn't phrase it that harshly, but okay, I can get that there's, but they have a paper. Oh man, I should have written down the author's name. They have a paper. And again, this is part of the required reading, part of what you're allowed to use to support your arguments. All right. One of the few things you're allowed to use to support your arguments in this class. And the paper is written by, oh man, I wish I could remember his name. I'll have to look it up. But it is a paper, published in, in a scholarly journal, in 1980. So it is 38 years old. And in this paper, the guy is talking about, again, the power of citizenship and shared values, and that is required if we are going to grow as a nation, as we're going to advance and grow and prosper. We need to have shared values that are shared across all citizens. And then specifically says, look, this is why the black people in the ghettos can't ever get ahead, is because they don't share our values. And thus, the solution is they need to be educated. It needs to be forced on them if necessary. And so, I mean, like he advocates that, yes, we need to go into these inner city schools, these ghetto schools. He always said ghetto. That was in which in 1980, ghetto was not a perfectly PC word. That was how you could refer to the inner city. But he says, yeah, we need to go into these ghetto schools and we need to educate these young black people in our values and force them on them if necessary. I mean, he refers to it as a trial by fire. And is this level of force and coercion really necessary? And he says, yes, an emphatic yes. If we want to survive as a nation, this is what we have to do. And my initial reaction, and then Yancey was so shocked by it that he also shared it with another guy that comes into our office and shares it with him as well. And he had the exact same reaction. You listen to all of it and you're like, yeah, yeah, those are the words they used to take American Indian children away from their parents and send them off to good Christian boarding schools to raise them in proper civilized values. It's the exact same language, the exact same wording. This course is openly racist, and it's required. It's a mandatory course for anyone who wants to get an undergraduate degree from Bellevue University. It's just mandatory. And okay. Can I say it's openly racist? Man, it seems to me, in my opinion, those words seem to be supporting racist viewpoints that I thought were long outdated. Well, outdated in most quarters. And yet, nope, still alive and well, going strong. Just horrifying. And, all right, and then here's the other thing about the Kirkpatrick signature series of courses is, go online and look at reviews of Bellevue University, look at reviews of these professors, of this course, and a lot of people feel that the Kirkpatrick signature series was kind of sprung on them. Like, they were given the impression, as they're being sold on going to this college, they were given the impression that, oh, well, to get my degree, it's about $13,000 or so, for the 4 years to get my degree. And then they've gone through it all and they've spent their $13,000. And then this Kirkpatrick signature series comes up at the end and they're like, oh, well, yeah, of course you also have the required Kirkpatrick signature series. That's an extra cost of $3,600 thrown on top of that $13,000 you were already planning for. And this is where Yancey's at right now, is that he went through the whole thing and now, yeah, it was $3,600 for this final course. And now he knew that was going to be the cost, because he went into this knowing he was going to spend about $18,000, $20,000. He knew that. All right. But he didn't know that this is what it was going to require. And so a lot of people feel that they were deceived by the advisors that kind of sold them on this. They feel that this was intentionally glossed over or left out. And the defenders of the program will say, hey, what did it? It's all there. If you had read, if you had bothered to read the requirements for the degree, you would have seen all of this. To which the response is, you know, not everybody can be an expert on that stuff. Not everybody is going to be able to look past what an advisor is telling them, what a salesman is telling them. Not everybody's going to be able to look past that and catch all the details in the fine print, because there's a lot of shit there. All right. And so, yeah, technically they should have known. They should have. It was right there in black and white. God, if you had just read it, you would have seen it. But, people feel deceived, and thus, it gives the impression that Bellevue is not, while they do put it in black and white, it's right there. Legally, I'm sure everything is covered. They're maybe not as, upfront or emphatic about it when they present it as they really ought to be or could be, one would say. So that's the rage, is the, really? That's what we're doing? I mean, it's like, yeah, I understand that conservatives feel like modern universities are so liberal and that their kids are being brainwashed and that, you know, these liberal professors will shout down anyone with opposing viewpoints and, you know, shout down anyone who disagrees with them. And I know that that's what they believe. And maybe there are cases of that. I have not been part of the university system for almost 30 years. So I don't know what's really out there. I should ask some of my friends who are in higher education, and see what their opinion is of it. But, you know, now Yancey is left with a choice. He's like, he feels really, really gross, having to do this, because it's becoming clearer as this course goes on that if he wants to continue this course, finish it out, and get his degree, he is going to have to write papers that they want. He's going to have to write the answers that, even though they say there's no wrong answers, there's no bad opinions, there clearly are, and he's going to need to write the papers that they want to see. And so you're left with a choice. Do you write the papers that they want to see, compromise yourself, and say things you don't really believe in just because, look, you've gotten this far, let's finish it out? Or do you take a chance and, within their guidelines, write your honest opinion, knowing that, I mean, he's been, you know, on a roll this whole time. He's taking his education very seriously. And is he going to give them his honest opinion in this class, knowing that it's not going to make any difference to them? All right. But give them his honest opinion, in his papers, which means he may wind up failing anyway by giving them the wrong answers, or may wind up, even if he does pass, wind up with a grade that takes him off the honor roll and looks, you know, it's a black mark on his transcript. Or ultimately, does he decide that he can't put up with this crap at all and then just pull out of the program, get half of his money back on this course, and then hope his credits transfer to another university or another college where he can finish out his degree, another year or 2 years from now, rather than just getting it done here in the next few months? That's a tough decision. Yeah, me personally, I told him, look, it doesn't make any difference. You know what they want to hear. It's easy to write the papers. Who cares? Just give them what they want. They've already got your money. You've already done all the work to qualify for a degree. If they want this final piece of crap, then give it to them and walk away. I mean, look, take your degree and get out. You've paid for it. All right. But he's a man of principle, and I don't know if he's going to be able to do that. So we'll see what he finally decides. But, like I say, if it was me, standing up to them isn't going to do anything. What, are you going to take them to court over it? How much time and money do you have to put into that garbage? Are you going to, and especially when you, what are you going to take them to court over? They probably technically, legally haven't done anything wrong. So, you know, if, I don't know, it's a tough one. So anyway, I feel bad for Yancey. And again, this is just, it's just shocking. Just shocking. All right. Next up. Oh, let's do science fiction double feature. Science fiction double feature. That's right. Here at Nerd Pride, you get not one, but two movies for the same low, low price. All right. What are the last two movies I've seen? The last two movies I've seen are VHS 2, and The Greatest Showman, which I saw twice, actually, in the last 2 days. And I'll explain that in a minute. And I'm reviewing VHS 2 only because I have to give you two movies for the same low, low price. I'll just tell you, the VHS series of horror movies, we saw the original VHS, and then Lisa and Aiden and I decided that we would watch VHS 2 as a follow-up to that. And I like the VHS series. Some of them are stupid as hell, but some of them are really good. It's, for what it's worth, you know, the framing device is we wind up in a place with lots of VHS tapes, and for some reason we are compelled to watch these VHS tapes, and each one has a horror short story on it. So it's like an anthology, but unlike most horror anthologies, I enjoy these. I look forward to watching more of these. There's a third VHS. Oh, I can't remember. Can't remember what the name of the third one is, but it's on Netflix. So we'll wind up watching that one coming up soon too. And then, like I say, some of them are stupid as hell and a waste of time, but some of them are kind of clever. I like a good horror short story. So, you know, VHS 2, it was all right. But The Greatest Showman is the based on the life of P.T. Barnum, starring Hugh Jackman, and it's a musical. And it is glorious and wonderful. Just had a great time watching it. I'll tell you right now that if you're looking for historical accuracy, this is not it. This is a feel-good musical inspired by the life of P.T. Barnum, okay? This is not intended to be historically accurate. It is not. I saw more than enough reviews that complained because why would they give us this watered down version when P.T. Barnum had such a rich life and so many interesting things? And why didn't we show the real nitty gritty of who this man was? And why didn't, because that's not what this movie was. I think a modern telling of the real nitty gritty life of P.T. Barnum, I think would be an awesome story, or even better, an awesome, series on like HBO or whatever. I would love that. I think that would be awesome, but that's not what this movie was. This movie was a feel-good musical, and it was so fun. Yes, the story was simplified, and it was watered down, and it was, you saw troubles arise, and then you saw these easy solutions come around because, you know, it's just a matter of singing the right song. But it wasn't about the story. It was about these characters, and it was about the choreography, the dance numbers. I have never in my life have I watched a movie and thought, wow, that choreography made it all worth it. But it did. It did. It was just lovely fun. And so we wound up seeing it. Me and Lisa and Aiden and Noah all went last night. And we enjoyed it so well that I invited Eli and Jacob to go to see it today, because we're a theater drama family. All the kids are involved in theater, and this was the kind of thing that just, I could just see this just resounding with them. Really, it's in their wheelhouse. And Jacob, unfortunately, could not go. I think Jacob would have adored this. Adored. But, sadly, Jacob couldn't make it, but Eli and I went today and watched it again. Eli also enjoyed it. We had so much fun. So much fun. I mean, like I say, it's a musical, and Noah, at 12 years old, was into it. I can't imagine my parents taking me to a big musical like this when I was 12. I would have sneered at that stuff and walked off. I couldn't stand musicals at that age. But, man, everybody loved it. And like I say, it's, again, if you're looking for, the truth about P.T. Barnum's life, you ain't gonna find it here. And, you know, if you're looking for some really cool singing and dancing, this is the movie for you. It was really great. I had a great time. So, it was totally worth it. So, there you go. That's our science fiction double feature. Last of all, you know what? We're gonna do some fingertips.
Fingertips. Fingertips. Fingertips.
Yeah, fingertips is the stuff on my master list that I don't feel like fleshing out into full topics, so I'll just give you the down and dirty on each one as we go. First off, I had to go to the State Patrol office this week and get my fingerprints done, and they're going to run a background check on me and all this, because since the merger and reorganization of the technical department of the state of Nebraska, I now am qualified to work in any state office. Up till now, I've always been Health and Human Services, but now I can work in any state office, and that includes working at State Patrol, working at the Revenue Service, working at the Treasury's offices in the counties, working in the, I mean, lots of places where apparently they need to run a background check on me before I go sticking my hands into all their files. So that's what I did. And the fingerprinting, here's the cool part about it. Have you been fingerprinted lately? Oh my God. I haven't been fingerprinted in ages, like probably since I had it done as a Cub Scout. Or in fact, no, I probably had my fingerprints done like sometime when I took my Cub Scouts on a field trip to the sheriff's office or something like that. And the last time I saw fingerprinting done, it was still being done with ink. And duh, I don't even know why this surprised me. I get down there to get it done, and of course there's no ink anymore. Why would you have to ink up suspects to get fingerprints anymore? My phone can scan my thumbprint just by swiping my thumb over it. You would think that the cops could have at least that good of technology, and they do. So they take my fingerprints by, the woman. I put my fingers on the glass, and the woman rolls my fingers around to get the right, get the full scan of all the sides and the tip and the whole business. And it was just cool watching it, because as she's rolling my fingers around, you can see the fingerprint slowly coming into focus on the screen until she's sure she's got a clear enough picture. Okay, good. That one's done. Let's start on the next one. It was really cool. I haven't been fingerprinted in decades. This was awesome. So that was that one. All right. Next up on fingertips, I am listening to Doug Loves Movies this week, a podcast that I really enjoy. Doug Benson, if you don't listen to Doug Loves Movies, it takes a little bit to get used to because it is very idiosyncratic. He has a lot of inside jokes and it follows certain patterns that you're not going to get a lot of it the first couple of times, but it's still really entertaining. And the show is ostensibly a game show where Doug asks movie-related questions of his guests, and that part is interesting, and I really enjoy the games, but, you know, the show is typically like an hour and a half long, and the first half of the show is nothing but introducing the guests and having conversations. So it's like 45 minutes of them just bullshitting, and they're funny, and they're fun, and it's, I just really enjoy Doug. So I'm listening to Doug Loves Movies this week, and two of his guests are Dan Harmon and Jeff Davis. Dan Harmon, who is, of course, creator of Community, creator of Rick and Morty, and he has his own podcast called Harmontown, which I used to listen to religiously. I loved Harmontown. Eventually, yeah, it's Harmontown is always really good when Dan is not doing well. When his career is kind of on the rocks, then he gets a level of humility and introspection that, you know, he's still kind of an ass, but he winds up, he's really entertaining to listen to during those periods. And it's sad to say that when his life is having troubles, that's when he's most entertaining as a human being. But it's true. And then he gets success and things are going well for him. And then he gets really megalomaniacal about it. He's in his head and he starts, you know, he goes off pontificating on things and he's the ultimate authority and he knows everything and he's way less interesting for me to listen to. And so the last time he got to one of those stages, I just gave up on Harmontown and kind of walked away from it. But I haven't listened to Harmontown in a couple of years, but here's Dan Harmon and Jeff Davis, on Doug Loves Movies. Jeff Davis, who is, he's the skinny guy who's always wearing a suit on Whose Line Is It Anyway? So he wasn't one of the main three on Whose Line, but the main three were, on the American version at least, was Colin Mochrie and Ryan Stiles, and hold on a second, Aiden's home. He's apparently only home for a few minutes to fetch a TV, and then he's leaving again, so he's going to make some more noise here in a minute. But anyway, the main American cast of Whose Line is Colin Mochrie, Ryan Stiles, Wayne Brady. And then they'll always have a rotating fourth guest. Greg Proops is there a lot. Brad Sherwood. But also Jeff Davis, who I love. And when listening to Harmontown, because Jeff Davis is the comptroller of Harmontown, which just means he's the co-host, but My favorite part of Harmontown was always Kumail Nanjiani. Anytime Kumail was on, he was my favorite part of the show. But assuming Kumail's not around, Jeff Davis is my favorite part of Harmontown. I love Jeff. I think he's great. And it was just odd listening to Doug Loves Movies and hearing the two of them. And I'm like, it was so nostalgic. Like, Dan came out and within 3 minutes of Dan Harmon talking, I'm like, oh God, he's going to get on my nerves. He's pretending to have humility about something, and he won't let this joke go about, and anyway, I could tell he was just going to annoy me the whole time, and he wasn't as bad as I thought, but, oh, it just felt like it. But Jeff Davis, it was like, oh, I miss Jeff. I miss Jeff enough that I could almost go back to listening to Harmontown just to hear Jeff Davis talk for a while, but, yeah, I'm not going to do that. So, anyway. It's just a moment I had this week, where all that long explanation, all of that build up just to go, God, I miss Jeff Davis. Ah, darn. Okay. So anyway, that's it. I was in a training this week, and in this training, they've changed some of their terminology about stuff, and they have not, like the human resources person who was talking to us recognizes what this sounds like, and she said, you know, this isn't the final decided terminology, but this is what they're going with for right now. And throughout the training, every time they wanted to talk about managers, they didn't talk about managers or supervisors or any, didn't use any traditional terms for it. Instead, they were referred to as people leaders. People, those who lead people. People leaders. Yeah, that's right. People eaters, one-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eaters. It was hysterical. I cannot believe they were so stupid as to even let that get past the brainstorming phase and actually into circulation, like this is what they're going to be going for. Like, she says it's not their final wording, but then why is it in our training? Why is it in the mandatory training for every employee we have? You've decided you want people eaters. That's just dumb. Okay. But it still makes me laugh, and once this whole thing has phased out and it's no more, I am going to be reminding them of people eaters forever. I am going to refer to all the managers and supervisors as people eaters from now on. I think it's great. My son Elijah came to me this week, and he was really tired, and he had a question and said, why your eyes want to close when you get tired? Why specifically, like, I go all day long and I don't have any problem, and at the end of the day I start to get tired and my eyes get all heavy. Why is that? And so I thought this was a really good question. I have no idea. I assumed, like, I thought it was going to be something along the lines of, it is a natural reaction that when your body, you know, knows it's ready for sleep, that you get this, you know, like, you know, when you get nose irritation, all of a sudden your eyes start watering and you get, you know, there's like certain reactions in the body that just kind of natural. And no, the answer, and this comes from Scientific American did a whole article on why your eyes get heavy. And in Scientific American, the sum total of the answer is because your eye muscles are fatigued. Like, literally, that's it. It's like when you get to the end of the day, you get tired. All your muscles get fatigued, and especially your eye muscles, because your eye muscles are active all day long. And when it gets about time for sleep, that's about when they've reached their limit for the day. And yes, your eyes are going to get heavy because the muscles are tired of doing crap for you. It was as simple as that. Weird. So, okay, learn something. All right, last thing. I went and joined the Flat Earth Society forums, because I had a question for them. I wound up stumbling across the Flat Earth Society forums by accident. I can't remember what I was doing a search for, but I wound up finding a link to the Flat Earth Frequently Asked Questions page, and it was fascinating. Because look, I understand that flat earthers truly believe that the Earth is flat, and they think they have evidence for it. And so on their Frequently Asked Questions page, it was a, oh, I remember why. I needed a, a quote that was obviously from a Flat Earth page. I just wanted to use a random quote on our one of our threads on the forums. Anyway, doesn't matter. And so I wound up getting to the Flat Earth Frequently Asked Questions page. And while I was there, like I say, I actually read all of their frequently asked questions. And it wound up just being so instructional on how they view the planet. And it seems that the generally agreed upon map of the flat Earth is a projection of the globe that has the North Pole in the center of the map. And so the northern hemisphere is then surrounding the North Pole, so that forms the center of the map. And then the southern hemisphere just keeps spreading out from there. And then at the outside edge of the circle, Antarctica, what round earthers mistakenly call the continent of Antarctica, is actually a giant wall of ice that surrounds all of the known Earth. And that's what the Earth looks like. And it is all flat. And according to them, that there are some people that have actually traveled past the Antarctic ice wall, but the reports on what is on the other side of the wall are sketchy. We have no information, really. Nobody really knows what's out there. It's a great question and a great place for us to be exploring. The night and day effect of the planet results from the sun moving in a circle around this big round map on average, about the level of where the equator would be in this circle. North Pole going out to the equator, then going out further through the southern hemisphere to the largest circle is the ice wall of Antarctica. And so the sun moves, on average, above where the equator is. And, well, then how come we have nighttime? Well, because the sun it's not a giant ball of gas that shines in all directions. It specifically shines downward like a spotlight. It's like a giant floating table lamp that only shines down in a spotlight on this section of the Earth. And as that circle moves around, we get the effect of night and day. All right. Yeah, it's stupid. I get it. But man, to them, they're covering all their bases and they have all these explanations of how even when you're traveling high up in airplanes or even in spacecraft, when you get high enough up that it looks like you're seeing the curvature of the Earth, no, that's just an artifact of the way cameras work, and that's the artifact of blah, blah, blah. It's like they have an answer for everything. And so I'm thinking to myself, here's the ultimate question, as far as I'm concerned. It's like, okay, yeah, but here's the thing. If you look at that map, as I'm looking at their map, their North Pole-centric map, it occurs to me that, okay, flight times. Flights in the Northern Hemisphere, as it's mapped out on theirs, would be measures out about normal for what you'd expect. That, if I want to fly New York to London, that's like 7 hours. If I want to fly LA to Tokyo, that's about 20 hours. And if you measure it out on the map, yeah, okay, LA to Tokyo is about three times as far on the map as the New York to London, so about three times as much time. That makes sense. But then you look at things like, let's go from Cape Town to, Cape Town in South Africa, and let's fly over to Buenos Aires in Argentina. If you can get a direct flight from Johannesburg to Buenos Aires, it's 9 hours, all right? So it's a little bit longer than that New York to London flight. And yet you look on this big projected map they've got out there, and it's like, oh, 4 or 5 times as far. I mean, it looks like if things were proportional, that this should really be something like a 4 or 5 hour trip. And yet, well, we know we can do it in 9 because people have done it. They've literally gotten on a plane in Johannesburg and wound up in Buenos Aires 9 hours later. Or getting that direct flight is really tough. Usually you actually have to make a layover in Brazil, but even then, it's still only 15, 16 hours, still way shorter. Okay, so to me, I'm like, this would seem like, if you look at any flights in the southern hemisphere, so South Africa, South America, Australia, look at flights from any of these, from one to the other, those flight times don't match up with your map. What the hell? And so I very politely go over to the Flat Earth forums. I go to the Flat Earth debate section. They have a space solely for having arguments about Flat Earth. And I pose up my question and say, hey, you know, I don't believe in this, but I'm intrigued, I'm new to it, and here's my question. Sadly, I couldn't get any flat earthers to actually respond to me, but apparently the flat earth forums are full of people who think flat earth philosophy is absolute crap, and they spend their times trolling those forums simply to shout down any flat earthers who want to try and have an opinion. I don't know if I necessarily agree with these people's methods, but yeah, okay, I get what they're doing. And so I ask my question, and a couple of them very politely come in to explain to me how, well, these flat earth idiots will tell you that, and they kind of explain to me what they think the flat earth philosophy is on these flight times. And according to them, flat earthers just deny that flights to the southern hemisphere even exist. That just doesn't happen. It's too far to fly. The only way to get to these locations, we don't have planes that can make that kind of trip. So therefore, any trip to Australia or the main portion of the continent of Africa or South America, any of those flights have to come from somewhere above them in the northern hemisphere, or, well, above them as I'm looking at a globe with north on top, but on their map would have to come from one of the more central locations outward. That flights around the northern hemisphere, quote unquote, are all pretty normal as we expect them. But if you want to get to anywhere in the southern hemisphere, then yeah, you need to actually be coming down from the north. You can't take direct flights. That's their argument, is you can't take direct flights from one point in the southern hemisphere to another point on a different continent because there's just no planes that can do it. And anyone who claims that they have done it is just a shill for the conspiracy that, oh, and so, and now the, again, these guys very, I don't know, very, very righteously posted up that this is what flat earthers would tell me, but then also politely offered links to threads where they do say exactly that. And so I followed them up and, oh yeah, yeah, their response to this is either to A, deny that such flights could possibly exist, claim that anyone who says that they do is just part of the conspiracy, or three, to just shunted off to another argument that says, well, yes, but triangles prove that the earth is flat, so therefore, I don't even know why I'm arguing with you about anything. It's just weird. The level of, I went into this thinking that I was just going to have a discussion. I just wanted to see what a discussion with a flat earther was like. And I was quickly schooled and pointed to places where my discussion with them had already been had by other people, and quickly realized that, oh God, I can't, why would I want to get involved with that? That can be nothing but frustrating. So I made my one post, I saw those responses, I followed the links, and then I walked away, and I'm never going to look back because that is just too painful. Like, these are people who would rather believe that there is a conspiracy that creates millions of fake pictures, fake Facebook posts, Instagram posts that talk about flying back and forth from one country to another in the southern hemisphere. And that all of that is this, I mean, millions of posts, millions of people, and that it's all fabricated. It's all this huge conspiracy, probably done with bots that just generate that sort of stuff automatically, right? That's probably how they do it. But they would rather believe that there's this huge conspiracy of government officials in tons of nations, almost every astrophysicist on the planet, people who are just taking vacations and living in these continents, that all of these millions of people are all working together to create the illusion of a round Earth for what? Again, there's no, like the best argument I could see them come up with was that, well, look, with all this, all this NASA funding for a round Earth, look, we just fake up some evidence and then we just pocket the rest of the money because everyone knows it's a flat Earth. This is all, oh my God, that's the best they could do, is that it's just a trick to get government money. But if the government's in on it, then what? Alright, anyway. See, it'll make you crazy. Make you crazy. It is, conspiracy thinking is just beyond me. And so much of it is creeping into so many aspects of our lives nowadays that, you know, I know people who, I don't know any flat earthers. I don't know any flat earthers personally, but we all know people that that believe in Bigfoot. At least I think we all do. I certainly do. And God, and I want to believe in Bigfoot, and yet I know it's not out there. I know people, I know them personally, who are pretty sure the moon landing was faked. Pretty sure. I just, you know, everyone knows people that think that the JFK assassination was this huge conspiracy on multiple levels of government. We all know those people. All right. Maybe you are those people, because boy, it certainly does seem fishy, doesn't it? We know, I mean, there's so much of it out there. And now getting into the whole idea that somehow Obama and his deep state government are still actively working to sabotage Trump and that they're planting all of this evidence and that it's, I mean, there's a lot of conspiracy thinking going on, and it's frustrating and it makes me sad because you can't talk to them. You can't convince people, and it's painful. All right. You know what? I'm going to let myself get too deep into this. Let's call an end to fingertips. Let's move on to the pod. Make sure this is turned on this time for once. There we go. O-matic. Hot dog. This is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 in his fully pimped out Pod-O-matic bubble, and he rolls up random topics for me to talk about. And where do these topics come from, you ask? Well, that is where you come in. If you guys want to hear me haver on about something, you send your questions or topics to me by email, or better yet, in a private message on my forums, and I will add them to my Pod-O-matic list. Because Pod-O-matic is about whatever you want it to be. All right, and here's the problem we're going to have this week. I'll just let you know right now, is that, oh, hold on. I'm getting them sorted. No, not there. I mentioned a couple weeks ago that we were running low. And then last week, I forgot to mention that we're low. So what has happened now is last week I had exactly 100 to start the show with. And now this week I have 93, apparently. 92? All right. So we are running low. So very, very possible if I happen to roll something higher than a 93, we're just not going to have any Pod-O-matics in there. So you guys need to send me some. I need new entries. I know Ron has been working on a couple, and I'm looking forward to when he finally sends them to me. And I think I have like 3 of them that are still in my inbox that I haven't transferred over. I think somebody sent me 3, and so I need to move those in. But other than that, man, we are short. So, you know, send me a half dozen. Send me 1. Send me 20. I don't care. But I would love to have more Pod-O-matics from you guys, because without them, I would actually have to think of things to talk about, and it seems so hard. So anyway, I'm still, as I'm doing this, I've been trying to sort out the list while I'm stalling here for time. But I will tell you that the number is 01. How about that? And 01, right here at the top of the list, is from Zimny. And Zimny says, which is the coolest style of kung fu? Snake style? Drunken fist? Monkey style? Okay, it's drunken monkey. Specifically, is a drunken monkey kung fu fighting Ben Franklin. That's the coolest kung fu you will ever see in your life. All props to my brother for creating the clone of Benjamin Franklin who fights in drunken monkey style, because that is one of the best role-playing characters ever. So much fun. God, we love that game. 69, dude. 69 is from, speaking of my brother Kyle, it's from Kyle. Kyle says, let's just assume you have classic X-ray vision, like Superman does. Not real X-rays that are going to harm people. Are you going to do anything good with it? Are you going to do anything bad with it? Can you make money off of it? Would you? All right. Presumably, I could use my X-ray vision to... I have a hard time imagining the good I could do with it other than, well, I may suppose that there's certain sciences and forensic stuff, and there are occupations where it would be handy to be able to see through things without harming them or harming people around it. I mean, imagine if I were an art restorer and could see through paintings to the lower layers. Imagine if I, you know, there's all sorts of places where that could be very useful. Would I do those things? I don't know. I would like to think I would. But, you know, there's also, just walking around seeing everybody naked all the time, which I assume would get really, really boring after about the first, couple hours. But, you know, you do it because, well, you have the ability, so you'd check it out, and then you'd go, okay, yeah, now it's not exciting anymore. All right. You could certainly use it at the gas station to check out which scratch tickets are going to win, and if the next one or two in line are going to win, then okay, you buy those, and if they aren't, then you don't. You could certainly use it to cheat at cards. You could actually make a fair bit off of that playing blackjack at any casino, one assumes. You'd have to be careful because they'd be a little suspicious if you win too much, but I think you could get away with it in small amounts. So, you know, come up with a system. Maybe hook up with a professional gambler who knows what's suspicious and what's not, and figure out how to hit it so that they don't. Anyway, there's things you could do, but would I do that? Would I use my X-ray vision to cheat people and make money? Oh, I'd like to think I wouldn't, but I don't know. It's so tempting. And look, it's just a casino, and it's not like I'm going to take them for millions. I'm going to take them for a little pocket cash. I'm just going to make a little money here. That's all. Yeah. Or the stupid scratch-off tickets. It's like, you, come on, seriously. Somebody had to win them. Why not me? Really? It would be easy to justify, is what I'm saying. I don't know if I'd do it, but I'd certainly be tempted. 96. 96 is not a thing. We don't have a number 96. So, but you know what? I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to come down here and I'm going to label it. Oh, wait, we do. All right. Why does the number say we only have 93 if I actually have 97? That's weird. My counter is off. All right. We're not as broken as I thought. 'Cause 96 is from Kaz. Kaz says, which Steve Jackson game should be available for online play? My personal vote is Ogre, but I want to hear what you have to say. Available for online play? Well, all of them, but, I don't know. I personally, the Steve Jackson games from way back that I was into, I had Ogre, I played Ogre, but, really, I was Melee and Car Wars, and I'm gonna vote Melee, because I love Melee. I love that game. I don't like it as a role-playing game, I just like it as, Gladiator Combat. That's why I wrote Animal Ball Melee as a game, a tribute to the original, as a game of D20-based gladiatorial combat. It's just simple and awesome and effective. I loved playing Melee. 56. 56 comes from, let's see, there we go, 56 is from Talvin. Talvin says, können Sie Deutsch sprechen? Slightly. I mean, like 3 years of high school German doesn't mean I can speak German, but I can certainly read that. Something Francois. No, I don't speak any French, or Espanol. So, I guess my answers are nein, no, and no. Yeah, that's the right words. So, I mean, like I say, I have taken just enough German that I recognize, you know, 50 words. So certainly not enough to speak it. Not even enough to be brokenly functional, but, you know, enough to pick up basic street signs or stuff like that. That's about it. 42. Although I will tell you, Eli is taking Spanish right now. It's just an intro to Spanish. It's like the exploratory classes, you know, so they take it for 6 weeks or 8 weeks or whatever it is in junior high. And as I did with Aiden, I think I told you guys about this years ago when Aiden was taking Spanish. I love studying Spanish, and when we review words, we'll do the flashcards to review the Spanish words. And every time I have to say anything in Spanish, I do it as a very exaggerated George W. Bush. Or more accurately, I do it in an accent that sounds like Will Ferrell's impression of George W. Bush trying to speak Spanish, which is unfair to the former president because he speaks fluent Spanish. But I imagine that, like, all right, for example, La Grapidora is the stapler, which is where I get my El Grapidoro title. But La Grapidora, La Grapidora, that's, or Saturday night, Sabado Noche, yeah, see? George W. Bush. And it's a terrible George Bush, and it's a terrible Spanish accent. But it really, really makes me happy. So I guess I know a little bit of Spanish just from studying with the kids, but not enough to remember any of it. Like the days of the week and the months of the year. I just had to study with Eli again this last week, and I don't remember any of those from when Aiden was taking the class. I don't remember a single one, and I know I helped Aiden study. But it all disappeared from my head in the intervening 5 years, so there you go. The new number is 42. Did I say that? Yeah. And that's from Mrs. Darks. Mrs. Darks says, how do you feel about the word chow? Should it be reserved for animal food, or is it just food in general? Do you like it? No, I don't like the word chow all that much. I don't like it for animal food or people food. I am not thrilled with the snack food that is referred to often as puppy chow. It's tasty. Chocolate and powdered sugar on Chex. Who's going to argue with that? And yet, still like the name. I mean, it doesn't bother me. I'm not, you know, upset. Like, when referred to in the context of a military setting, the chow hall, chow line, I don't have any problem with that. Or even by association, you know, the idea of the college dining hall or something like that. More of a mass food setting. Then chow is a little more appropriate. But, I mean, it doesn't bother me, but it's also not a word I ever choose to use. I don't use chow in reference to anyone's food unless I'm specifically talking about dog chow or the snack food puppy chow. Other than that, nah, not my word. 08. 08. Let's see. It's from Phoebe. All right. I think that is 6 for 6. We have had 6 different people. I'm not going to ruin this record. Half dozen. We're going to call it here because we're over an hour anyway. So we're making great time tonight. Phoebe says, would you go into space if you were given the opportunity, for example, on a commercial space flight someday? If so, how far from Earth would you be willing to travel into space? Okay. I just had this conversation yesterday with my wife. And my wife would not go into space. That is just not a thing she's into. She said, you know what? If the planet were going to explode, if this was the end of the world and we're all crowding onto spaceships to try and travel out into space and find ourselves a new place to live, a new habitat, a new planet, something, she said, I probably would just stay here and wait for the end. She is not going into space. Myself, on the other hand, I am a cheapskate. And I can't imagine paying to go into space, like, or at least not paying a lot. Like, if we won the lottery and we had $500 million laying around, even then, am I going to pay, you know, a $10 million ticket for an actual space flight up to the International Space Station or whatever the cost is? I know it used to be $20 million. The Soviets would take you up there for $20 million. I don't know what the cost is today, but let's assume it's, you know, $10 million or $8 million. I would not plunk down that kind of money, even if I had the lottery winnings. I wouldn't pay that much to get myself into space. You know, if I was that wealthy and it was $10,000, maybe. Or certainly in any situation, if I've just won a trip to space and they're going to take me up for free, oh, God, yes, I'll go to space in a heartbeat. I am not scared of that. I mean, yes, I probably would be scared. It would be really nerve-wracking, but I would not pass that up. Get me on the Vomit Comet and just take me through a bunch of parabolic arcs to experience weightlessness for 15 minutes in tiny little chunks. I would do that in a heartbeat. I would go to space. I would go to the moon. I would, yes, I absolutely would do that if I had the chance to do it. But again, I'm cheap. I probably wouldn't pay a whole lot for it, but I would take the opportunity if it was given to me. Now, how far would I be willing to go? Certainly, I am thrilled to go into Earth orbit. I am just fine with taking a trip to the moon. I'll hang out at the space station. I'll go to the moon. Beyond that, no. Nope, not until we know more. I am certainly not one of these idiots willing to, yes, I'll take a one-way trip to Mars. I'd love to be the first Martian. No. No. No, because that is a ticket to a slow death by radiation cancer. That is slow and painful on a strange planet where you, oh, no, no, not going to do that. But again, I'll head into space. Yeah. 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 I'm not going to take the long trips until they work out all those, those kinks that could kill you. But yeah, maybe that's just me. All right. And then that is it. I said we were done. So let's move on and we'll turn it over to GLaDOS, who's going to give us a recap of this week's episode so far.
Remember when the platform was sliding into the fire pit and I said goodbye, and you were like,
no way.
And then I was all, we pretended we were going to murder you.
That was great.
This podcast is copyright 2018 by Nerd Pride Radio. The opening and closing theme is Death Metal Disco by Ian Kronk. My bumper music this week was Wonderful World by Sam Cooke, Fingertips by They Might Be Giants, and Science Fiction Double Feature as performed by Me First and the Gimme Gimmes. All the songs I use are available on iTunes, so you should check them out, buy them, and enjoy them, because I wouldn't put them in my podcast if I didn't love them. If you want to help out Nerd Pride, then subscribe to this podcast in iTunes or whatever podcatcher you're using, and write me a nice review, because those things make a difference. Actually, write a crappy review. Just give me 5 stars, because those are the things that really make a difference. If you want to do something super nice for me, though, seriously, just recommend Nerd Pride Radio to one of your friends, one of your super nerdy friends that you know is going to enjoy it, because, look, you're enjoying it. Why shouldn't they get the chance to enjoy it as well? Word of mouth, my bread and butter people. Listen, I am always looking for you listeners to do my work for me, so don't forget to send me questions and topics for the Podomatic. Please send me questions and topics for the Podomatic. I'm out. I'm completely out. I'm not completely out, but after these 6, now we're down to 91. So there you go. That's the official count right now. Watch out every week on the forums and on Facebook for listener betrayal. And if you have a really interesting nerd fact about an upcoming episode number, send it to me and save me all of that grueling research. The next number, for example, is 218. Can you find me something interesting about 218 or even 219? I mean, look, are you going to find me a 217-kilogram snatch? Probably not. But, you can get me something, right? All right. My contact information, mike@nerdprideradio.com, @nerdprideradio on Twitter, facebook.com/nerdprideradio. But to be completely honest, the very best way to talk to me is come sign up for my forums at nerdprideradio.com/nerds. You sign up there, you send me a message. We will hang out together. We will become best friends in the world. We'll have fun. And now it's time for listener betrayal. Before I start recording every podcast, I go out to my forums and to Facebook and I post up, hey guys, I am recording. Anything you post up, I will read off at the end of the podcast, which is what I'm doing right now. We'll start off at my forums, where I said, hey everybody, I know it's late, but ask me a question and tell me your shoe size, and nobody responded, because it's late on a Sunday night, so these things happen. For reference, my own shoe size is normally 12 and a half, but the current shoes I'm wearing 13, and they're really comfortable. So what they say about a guy with big feet: he wears big shoes. That's exactly right. Let's go over to Facebook, though. And on Facebook, I actually have several responses. Oh, okay. That explains these responses. I said, now recording episode 217, post here to be a part of it. And if you feel like it, share your favorite comfort food. Patrick, DM Darks. Pat says, beef ravioli with marinara sauce, 2 bags worth. What's your preferred pasta shape? My preferred pasta shape is, I just like pasta. I mean, it is really hard to say because I just really like pasta. I don't care much for spaghetti. I mean, I like spaghetti, but spaghetti noodles, a little boring. I mean, if you can have noodles for pasta like that, have fettuccine. My preferred shape, probably rotini. I really like the spiral noodles. Something about spirals is just, I don't know, the way it holds sauce, very comfortable. I enjoy it. Then Sarah Beth, Pat's wife, says, Sauerbraten and seriously? I have no idea how to pronounce that. AKA Spatzel. Okay, I know what Spatzel is. Sauerbraten. All right, I suppose. Okay, that's just my favorite food in general, but it gives me comfort. Okay, I would not have thought of that. But then she asks, what is your favorite birthday dessert? Oh, man. No one's ever asked me that. I will tell you that my favorite birthday dessert, you know what? I got a soft spot for, well, okay. Either some kind of like caramel cheesecake, peanut butter cheesecake, even chocolate. I don't mind chocolate. I don't care for the fruit cheesecakes as much as strawberry cheesecake and that kind of stuff. I would prefer like the caramel or whatever. Cheesecake is an awesome, dessert in general. Doesn't have to be for birthday, but specifically birthday dessert, a really good Dairy Queen ice cream cake. I mean, ice cream cake is good in general, but Dairy Queen ice cream cakes have that thick layer of fudge in between the ice cream and the cake, and it's got like little crumblies, like it's like an Oreo pie crust crumbled up right next to the fudge, usually mixed into the fudge a little bit. And that little layer of thick, syrupy chocolate in between the ice cream and the cake, just a winner. Oh my God, that stuff is so good. Since I was a little kid, I've always loved Dairy Queen ice cream cake. Man, that stuff is good. All right. Next up, though, Kaz says, favorite comfort food, peanut butter and bacon on toast. Oh, you know how to live, man. Peanut butter and bacon on toast. Again, for me, peanut butter and bacon, a little bit of Miracle Whip. Perfect balance. Love that sandwich. All right. Kaz, he has a question, though. Well, a sort of a question. He says, now, tell us what keeps you playing Paranoia. Oh, yeah, I've been slow lately, haven't I? Man, for those of you who are in on the game, I just work changed. I used to have time in, you know, over breaks or while waiting on tickets at work. I could have some time to start filling in some of those blanks, and I could have a Paranoia move ready a couple of times a week, and now I just don't. Like I say, we reorganized, and I just don't have that time, and so it's been rough. I'm down to like once a week, and I'm having to find time out, you know, outside of everything else, and I feel bad because it's slow, but we're getting to the end. For those of you who have been playing, you should know that this feels like we're getting to the end to me. Like maybe we're 85% of the way, something like that. So, and you know, I hesitate to say that because things can get weird. And so, you know, it's Paranoia. It could be that suddenly we all blow up and it's over on the next move, or it could be that I say 85% and then it drags out for another year because, oh God, somebody put a twist on it. Things just happen. But like I say, it feels like we're getting to that climax portion of it. We'll see. But what keeps me playing is I love the story. Like I say, right now it's, I don't have the time for it, and so it's a little intimidating every time I get to it. But then once I start putting them together, the players write the story for me. The players, they put all this work into, they're giving me their inner thoughts and monologues. They're giving me their motivations and contingency plans. And when I see it, it happens every time, no matter how complex things are, no matter how worried I am about, oh God, I have no idea what I'm going to do now. But I get there and I put all of their moves in front of me and I get them all just, you know, I just paste them all into a document together. And then once I see them, I kind of reorder them a little bit. And then the picture just writes itself. It's like, I know what's going to happen now. And yep, and it's going to be funny. And it always works out, and it always looks awesome. Like I say, it intimidates me at first, but man, once I start doing it, yeah, Paranoia is just a good tale. And it always comes out, I was about to say it comes out well, but at least it comes out entertaining, and that's what matters. So, thank you guys for pitching in. That's the end of it. So, I appreciate everything. You guys are wonderful. This has been a good week, and hopefully I'll get on some Paranoia. And hopefully I get some Podomatics from you guys. And we'll be back next week. You guys have been great. See you then.